happened? What happened?
You got shot.
What's your name? Wake up. What's your name?
Shit.
If there ever was a time, it would be now. That's all I'm saying. If there ever was a time to get on your feet, take it to the street. Cause you're the one that's getting played right now by the game they're playing. Come on, meet me down at the Cardi Park and say, oh, where are you?
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and today I'm calling in from beautiful Houston, Texas. I had a wonderful book event last night here for my book, Revolution, A Love Story. And, of course, you can get more information about that book at my blog, cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com. I'm heading to Austin for the next few days, and, of course, when you hear this, I'll already be on my way home to California. So anyway, if you want more information about my book, you can always check it out, like I said, at my blog. And I would also be happy to come to your community if you'd like to organize a book event for me. It just was really wonderful in Houston last night. But our guest today is author, blogger, peace and justice activist, my friend, and our dear Soapbox friend, David Swanson. David Swanson, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Wonderful to be here.
So you're a very busy man. You have all kinds of irons in the fire. But you recently published, I think, an edited a compilation called the MIC at 50. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, this is a book called The Military-Industrial Complex at 50. It's now just over 50 years since President Eisenhower used that phrase in his speech as he left office as president. And we held a conference here in Charlottesville, Virginia, where we brought together experts from within the military, within the CIA, within the government, and experts on civil liberties and on the natural environment and on the rule of law and every aspect of our society that faces assault or simply trade-offs because of the extent to which we dump our treasury into the military. And it was a wonderful conference. I've never had so many people tell me that, you know, how much they loved the conference. And we put together a book out of the out of the speeches. And the idea being that, you know, the military spending is the number one enemy of the environment, but we can't get the Sierra Club and the environmental groups to take it on. It's the number one enemy of civil liberties, and the ACLU will address all the symptoms, the torture, the detentions, but not the military spending, and so forth across every interest area. And if we could all come together and take on the root cause of our struggles, we could stop it.
Well, so this is something that, you know, it's very unpopular to have a criticism of the Occupy movement. But one of my criticisms of the Occupy movement, and then I'm not saying if I criticize it that I don't support it, because I do. But one of my criticisms is that they don't make that connection. I've been to Occupies all over the country, and I take my little statistics from the Cost of War. There's a website called The Cost of War. It tells you how much your state has sent for the War of Terror, tells you how much your county has sent for the War of Terror. It tells how much your town has sent to D.C. for the War of Terror. And I try to bring that to the Occupies and say, this is how much your own community has sent to Washington, D.C. since September 11th. Do you think there's anything that your community could do better with this money? And so the Occupy movement, in a large sense, hasn't really addressed this issue.
Well, I completely share your perspective 100%. I consider myself an occupier, and I share the criticism. It's not complete, of course. There are many Occupy encampments and movements that have addressed the issue to one degree or another, and the occupation that we began in Freedom Plaza in D.C. on October 6th was designed around this. But I think you're making the right case. The base military spending is over 10 times the war spending. So it's not just the wars, but it's, you know, it's over a $1 trillion banker bailout every single year that we never get back. And it, among other things, militarizes the police forces that attack the occupies.
Right. And for example, California, my own state, we had about a $26 billion deficit. And to reduce that deficit, my governor, Jerry Brown, wanted to raise taxes, or not raise taxes, but keep the tax increases in place from Schwarzenegger, and cut back $13 billion in education and essential services, where California, since 9/11, has sent the government, the federal government, $150 billion. That's $15 billion a year. Those are the essential services right there that Governor Brown wants to cut.
Yes, and meanwhile, the Democrats and that governor refused to put through a single-payer health coverage. You know, this is not rocket science. It's not a coincidence that other wealthy nations, less wealthy than our own, that don't dump all their money into the military, have higher education standards, higher quality of life, greater life expectancy, lower infant mortality, more sustainable energy policies, and all across the board. You know, this is not some sort of bizarre coincidence that by all these measures where we like to think of ourselves as number one and we're actually number 48 and number 52,
right.
other nations are doing better, and the primary difference is that they're not dumping over half of their public spending every year into a military machine.
Well, talk about Eisenhower's original speech when he was leaving office about warning the public about the military-industrial complex. What do you think that was all about? Because, of course, Eisenhower was a profound member of the military community, and we can't say that his hands were clean from war crimes or crimes against humanity.
Well, human beings are complex things, and Eisenhower had spoken more eloquently than in that speech prior to his presidency. He had talked about every dollar spent on bombs is food taken out of the mouths of hungry children and so forth. I mean, I like that speech even better, but he had gone on to serve the military-industrial complex as it developed. And in the very same speech in which he warns against the danger, he hypes the propaganda and the Soviet threat and the need to build the military-industrial complex regretfully because of the Soviet threat. You know, we couldn't help it, but I'm here to warn you it's dangerous. You know, that's not a sufficient approach to turn it around. But his warning, taken in itself and excerpted about the thoroughness to which our society would be corrupted in every aspect, including spiritually, by this disease of this empowerment of the military, was, you know, extremely eloquent and prescient, if unheeded, warning.
Well, then talk about what he originally wanted to say. He wanted to call it the military-industrial congressional complex.
Yes, wouldn't have been polite, wouldn't have been nice to Congress, but of course, to some extent, it has always made sense to call it that. We've since Eisenhower's time radically increased the size and the power of the military-industrial complex, and we've opened up more doors to legal bribery and a lack of oversight, so that you see Congress approving of the purchase of weaponry that is then funded through public dollars, and a little bit of that is turned around and put back into the Congress members' reelection campaigns, and at the same time, each weapon is manufactured in dozens of different districts in little pieces and then assembled in another one so that they can treat it as a jobs program. And it's an incredible fraud in that economists will tell you that those same number of dollars put into any other industry, put into education, infrastructure, et cetera, would produce more jobs, and even tax cuts for ordinary people would produce more jobs. It's worse than nothing just in economic terms, never mind all the other toxic side effects, but they treat it as a jobs program.
I heard a statistic somewhere, or not a statistic, a fact, that anywhere you stand in the United States, you're most places, you're not more than 50 miles away from a war profiteer.
Yeah, I can't imagine it's more than that. I could imagine it might be much less. I mean, it's hard to... There are places without sort of traditional military bases. If you go up to Oregon, there's one. But most of the country is full of military bases of one sort or another. And now, of course, you have this merging of the police and the military and these fusion centers and so forth. But if you talk about the so-called private aspect, that is these corporations that in many cases are existing purely through federal dollars, but they're called private. It's everywhere. Those contractors and their subcontractors are just about everywhere. It's almost impossible to buy a piece of clothing or a book or a meal or a computer and not be funding a military contractor or subcontractor. It's, you know, it's our whole economy. You know, it would in fact be damaging to the economy to simply cut it off. We have to take that money and put it into something else. We have to do conversion. We have to change
right.
these jobs into non-military jobs. But it's absolutely everywhere.
Well, I mean, some of the a major industry I think that the war machine could be converted into would be into environmental sustainability, and not just sustainability, but clean up the toxic waste dumps that the military has left all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, our own country is just pockmarked with Superfund sites from the military. The military has destroyed whole regions of the globe. Parts of Iraq have higher cancer than Hiroshima. It's rare for a child to be born without serious defects. Birds won't go to Afghanistan anymore with the trees gone. They're going to send dolphins through if the Strait of Hormuz gets mined. I mean, if you
yeah.
cared about the environment, the military, the number one consumer of petroleum, this insane monster that consumes a good chunk of the oil it fights the wars for, would be your number one target. You know, just as if you cared about the economy. But, you know, when are we going to see a labor union take on the military-industrial complex? When are we going to see an environmental group take it on?
Absolutely. Another issue that this brings up is I'm often asked, and David, you have a young darling son. I'm often asked, like, am I against the military? What would I do? How would I use a military? Or what do you think would be the, you know, the correct use for a military? Can you, you know, respond how you respond? I'm sure you're asked that question, too.
Well, we have in the United States a military that's more expensive than the rest of the world's combined, and many times more expensive than any of the rest of the world's militaries that can even plausibly be depicted as enemies of the United States. So what do we, I mean, I would start by, you know, cutting it down to, say, twice the size of China's, rather than several times. You know, I mean, if we were actually
times the size of China's.
Right. I mean, why wouldn't double be good enough if all we were trying to do was defend ourselves?
Right.
I mean, I would shut down the foreign bases. I would bring the troops home from the wars and the foreign bases. I would get rid of the technology that doesn't work, was designed for the 18th century, or serves no defensive purpose whatsoever, is purely offensive. I mean, that would be a start. I mean, ultimately, our goal needs to be getting rid of standing armies. You know, what the Nobel Peace Prize was supposed to be for, but isn't anymore, the advocacy of ridding the world of war and standing armies. And they play out these war game scenarios all the time. They've even played out how disastrous an Israeli strike on Iran will be for the United States. And they claim to be just just doing every possible scenario to see what could happen doesn't mean we want to go in this direction. But they never play out a peace game scenario. They never say, what if we tried to negotiate a nuclear free zone? What if we stopped arming Israel? What if we stopped arming Egypt? You know, they leave out 90% of the possible scenarios that would move us in the direction of beginning to demilitarize.
If the United States, well, there was actually a threat against the United States, I can't really remember when that actually occurred for reals. What would you be in favor of, a universal draft that included everybody, if it started? My plan, this is the Cindy Sheehan plan, if the United States actually had a threat, was that, first of all, the war would have to be constitutionally declared. Not that I think Congress has much of, you know, has tools to do that, but the first people that would go would be the draftable age children of the war profiteers. The second people that would go would be the draftable age children of the politicians. And then it would start with the draftable age people from the top of the economy down to the very last people to go would be the poor and the working class.
Yeah, well, I'm inclined to agree. You know, Senator Rand Paul, crazy as he might be on some issues, just stopped them from putting through a bill to facilitate a war on Iran. But Leon Panetta this month told Congress the president can start a war with or without you guys and with or without the United Nations, and in fact has done so in Libya. So, Congress is not inclined to speak up for itself. And getting the draft right, if there had to be a draft, I think would make a lot of sense. But they're unmanning the wars. They're making the wars fought by robots. They're sending the drones. They're avoiding the U.S. deaths, otherwise known in U.S. newspapers as the human deaths. And so, as a primary tool for ending war, I think we need a movement to end war. And, you know, in a book I wrote recently about the peace movement in the 1920s showed a very different kind of principled movement that got a treaty through that banned war. And with the exception of World War II, the rich countries haven't gone to war with each other since. The problem is that they make war on the poor countries of the world. And if we're going to end that, it's going to take a change of consciousness in our country, as well as the ability to control our government.
Well, the rich countries haven't gone to war against each other, but they've collaborated to go to war against the poor countries. So, you know, I mean, the UK joins the U.S., Germany joins the U.S., Sweden in the first outside military adventure in 500 years has troops in Afghanistan.
Right. The point I'm making is that there was a movement to abolish war that made some good first steps. I mean, since that treaty in 1928, internationally, the gains of territory made through war are no longer recognized. War is a crime. It was prosecuted as a crime for the first time ever after World War II. Of course, only against one side, not the other.
Right.
And war is diminishing. A smaller percentage of humanity dies in war now than in decades past and centuries past. The problem is the other trend, which is that the United States has turned itself into a war economy, a war nation with a single individual empowered to make war with worse weaponry than ever before seen. And we've lost the idea that war is murder. You know, they want us to get upset about urination on corpses, but not about producing the corpses. We're not supposed to think of war as evil anymore, because it's our primary government program.
Well, let's talk about Obama now. Both you and I I've been involved in this since Casey died. I met you shortly after my son died, so we've been working on all this stuff together for a long time. It seemed like we had more help and we had more people come out to our rallies and to our other activities when Bush was president. But did you see these organizations, environmental organizations, the labor movement and things like that, did they connect the military-industrial complex to labor and the environment when Bush was president, or is that something that they historically try to avoid?
They historically tried to avoid. I mean, the last we saw of any real push for military conversion in Washington was back when the Soviet Union collapsed, and you know, back in the early 90s, hasn't been heard from since. And Newt Gingrich sort of led the charge that blocked that bill for military conversion back then. The labor unions, you know, sold out in the 1950s. They are, by and large, in favor of war and of U.S. empire, and they are afraid of their own shadow, as are the environmentalist groups. I mean, if you're priority was stopping torture or stopping environmental destruction, why would you want to take on this incredible, powerful beast, the military-industrial complex? The corporate media would hate you. Your donors would hate you. You know, but if we all took it on together, if all of the progressive groups, perhaps led by an independent young movement in public encampments, for example, if somehow we all took it on together, working people and the natural world and our civil liberties and everything else would be far better off. We could do it. It's just that nobody wants to stick their neck out on their own.
Well, David, you mentioned the collapse of the Soviet Union, and of course our history books want to say that it collapsed because Reagan said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall," or something like that. But, you know, most serious analysis thinks that the Soviet Union collapsed because of its devotion to its military-industrial complex, and of course its decade-long unsuccessful effort to subdue the people of Afghanistan in its proxy, you know, in the U.S. proxy war there against the Soviet Union. So what chances do you think we have as surviving, you know, as an empire, as the United States of America, if we don't voluntarily reduce our dependence on the military-industrial complex?
Oh, I don't think the empire can survive. I don't think the current state of affairs can endure. I think the economic collapse that you see periodically, including around 2008, is the direct result of dumping all of our money into the military and our failure to develop a serious economy that exports other types of products. You know, this is our big export. We are arming the rest of the world. We are fighting our wars against U.S. made weapons. We are instigating wars between pairs of nations that are using U.S. made weapons. Until we develop a different type of economy where we manufacture other products that can be openly sold without this worry of dual-use technology and so forth, until we begin to undo the war machine, this economy will collapse again, among other dangers of blowback proliferation and environmental collapse.
Well, David, I always have to wonder if Casey was killed by a weapon that was sold to Saddam Hussein when he was his war against Iran, when Saddam was the friend of the United States military-industrial complex. So that's something that I'll always have to struggle with. But we're almost out of time. Can you tell my listeners what you're doing now, what they can help you with, and how they can get a hold of you?
Yeah, well, I blog at davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org, and you can go to warisacrime.org and click on events and see a listing of upcoming activist events everywhere and in particular places. We are starting the occupation in Washington, D.C. back up now. April is going to be absolutely packed with activism. There is a general strike everywhere on May 1st, and the protest of NATO and the G8 in Chicago on May 20th is likely to be the biggest showing of anti-war activism in the country this year, and I hope everyone can make it to that, if nothing else.
Did they separate the NATO and the G8? Aren't they having the G8 at Camp David now, but NATO's still in Chicago?
That's correct. I think in part because the G8 was scared of being near non-billionaires who were angry, and in part because Russia wants nothing to do with NATO as NATO builds aggressive so-called missile defensive sites around Russia. So a little bit of disagreement within the 1% there. But there will be a protest, I'm sure, at Camp David as well. But the protest
right,
in Chicago...
Right, for our comrades who can't make it to Chicago and are near you, they can always go to Camp David. But I agree, I think that we need to have a huge presence in Chicago against NATO and against the U.S. And NATO crimes.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, Camp David is at a campground, for goodness sakes. You know, we've been trying to camp in public squares. Let's go camp there. But Chicago is going to be a protest of NATO and the G8, even if NATO is the only one present.
Right.
And a protest of the restrictions on our civil liberties that Mayor Rahm and his gang have been trying to impose there in Chicago.
Not Rahm Emanuel. He's a Democrat.
Yeah.
Are you trying to tell me the Democrats?
You know the
Democrats do this kind of thing too.
You know the Democrats make our wars, Cindy.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons that the environmentalists and the labor movement aren't outspoken against the military-industrial complex, because they know that it implicates the political party that they have the most allegiance to.
That's absolutely right. That's a huge part of it. And the AFL-CIO, with this, you know, premature electoral dysfunction, has gone ahead and endorsed Obama for president, you know, having dumped hundreds of millions of dollars into him last time with nothing to show for it. It's this lesser evilism that doesn't just happen in the voting booth, but then throughout the two-year period when you're not voting. You treat the government as a football game and cheer for one team. It's disastrous for this idea of government by the people. You can't stop being a person and be a servant of one brand of public servant. It's a disaster, and we're going to have to shake some of these organizations out of it while building new ones, and that's where I think the Occupy movement can help.
Looks like Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report says that Obama is not the lesser of two evils, he's the more effective of two evils.
Well, that's right. In many ways, he gets away with things that Bush never could have gotten away with, and this has been the pattern for decades. Glenn and I were at the United National Anti-War Coalition Conference recently, and at Left Forum, and he's a terrific guy who's got it just right. Obama has claimed the right to kill anyone, anytime, anywhere, to imprison or spy on anyone, anytime, anywhere, to launch wars without Congress or the UN or NATO. I mean, he has claimed every power. He's put it through an executive order that says, I will take over the government and run it as I see fit and take over private factories for war purposes. You know, what Truman almost got impeached for, what the Supreme Court had to stop Harry Truman from doing. We don't have a decent, you know, bone in the Supreme Court or the Congress. We have all power to the president, and we have presidents who are the good war makers rather than the bad. So we have war for humanitarian purposes, even though it never does humanity a bit of good.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good way to end the interview. So, David Swanson, tell your websites one more time, because that was quite a while ago that you did that now.
davidswanson.org and warisacrime.org. And thank you, Cindy, for everything you're doing.
And you too, David. It's always great to talk to you.
Thanks.
Well, that was our show today. I hope you check out David's blog and David's website and all of David's publications also. I'd like to thank, as usual, my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey. I'd like to thank you for listening, and my guest today, David Swanson. This is Cindy Sheehan, and you've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Thank you. Peace out.
I'll tell you again, the plans to stand together up to green. And a tear gas can in a veteran's face won't change the case.